Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the rash of anti-Semitic attacks on Jewish cemeteries and community centres, with 500 headstones desecrated at a Jewish graveyard in Philadelphia less than a week after a similar outrage in St. Louis. Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss the more than 160 bomb threats made to over 60 Jewish community centers since January. And with anti-Semitic incidents on the decline prior to this, we'll look into what factors might be involved in this upsurge of hate in the country that coincides with the arrival of the Trump presidency. We will also discuss Trump's slow reaction to these hate crimes and his response to Jewish reporters who raised the issue to Trump only to be met with hostility and evasion. Then we'll explore how technology is disrupting democracy and, if used maliciously, could undermine it further. Johann Bohlen, a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing, who previously was a staff scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, joins us to discuss the recent article in the Guardian that investigates the role of algorithms in social media and the activities of Robert Mercer, the right-wing billionaire who is close to Donald Trump, Stephen Bannon, and Nigel Farage, and the war he is waging on the mainstream media by creating a multi-million dollar propaganda network that funds Breitbart, proliferates fake news, and spreads global warming denial disinformation. Then finally, we will speak with Roxana Turan, who covers defense business, national security, and Congress for Bloomberg News, about the historic increase in defense spending Donald Trump is proposing for 2018, with an extra $54 billion being added at the expense of cuts in the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department, whose budgets are $8 billion and $50 billion respectively, compared to the $600 billion that goes to the Pentagon. We will also examine Senator John McCain's criticism of the additional 10% in defense spending, which he thinks is not enough. And before we begin, I'd like to invite you to the UC Hammer Forum that I'm moderating this coming Wednesday, March the 1st at 7:30 p.m., Standing Tall for Tribal Rights. We'll be looking into the largest Native American protest in history against the Dakota Access Pipeline with UCLA law professors Carol Goldberg and Angela Riley and activist Melanie Yazzie, who will be discussing tribal sovereignty and Indian rights again. Wednesday, March the 1st at 7:30 p.m., Standing Tall for Tribal Rights at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Westwood, free and open to the public. Join me. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in the analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and recently testified before the Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And Brian, there have been a desecration of almost 500 headstones at a Jewish graveyard in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. And that follows a week ago, a Jewish cemetery in St. Louis, Missouri was defaced. And on top of that, there have been at least 13 Jewish community centers and 7 day schools in Alabama, North Carolina, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Indiana, Pennsylvania, Florida, Maryland, Michigan, Virginia, Rhode Island, and Delaware that have received threatening phone calls. And that means that there have been more than 160 bomb threats made to over 60 Jewish community centers since January. So what's happening in this country?
Well, great question. And let me just tell you statistically what's happening, because that's something that I don't have to have a great deal of conjecture on. And that is, after an over 10-year decline, 2015 saw a 9% increase in anti-Semitic hate crime, according to the FBI. And if you look at our center's data and also the ADL's data, both of which skewed a bit towards more populated places, the increase across the rest of the country was higher than the increase in places where there were clusters of Jewish people, which seems to me to say that this is a bit of a nationwide trend, which may reflect the fact that these stereotypes and the promotion of them has allowed a certain subgroup of people to believe that it's socially acceptable to do this. And I think part of that is related to the socio-political mainstreaming, for a while at least, of some alt-right folks.
So, in other words, is it undeniable coincidence that there's an uptick in anti-Semitic acts, bomb threats, and defacing Jewish cemeteries since the emergence of Donald Trump, both as a candidate and now as president of the United States?
Well, there's certainly a correlation. But again, you know, we'll get better statistics. Some of this can be tied to other things, like a catalytic event, like a terrorist attack or an election. But to give you an example, another part of our study hit on exactly what you mentioned now, and that is we took the number of anti-Muslim hate crimes in the United States in the 5 days following then-candidate Trump's Muslim ban proposal. There was an 87.5% increase over the previous 5 days, which reflected an increase because of the San Bernardino terrorist attacks. When we look back at 2001, President Bush on September 17th spoke of tolerance. Hate crimes dropped by 47 to 66%, depending on what day you put the dividing line on.
Well, we know so far that efforts to alert President Trump about what's happening first came from an Israeli reporter when Netanyahu was visiting the White House. And rather than answer the Israeli reporter's question about the rise in anti-Semitic vandalism and bomb threats to Jewish centers, Trump launched into this strange discussion about how great his electoral victory was. And then subsequent to that, in a recent press conference, a Orthodox Jew from a publication asked the same question or a similar question, and Trump told him to sit down and then went into this long explanation about why he's not anti-Semitic personally and how, talking about his daughter being married to a Jewish husband and having their kids converted and all this stuff that's completely irrelevant. So subsequent to that, of course, at the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., he did make a statement. But I think it's inescapable that just as Trump took forever to dissociate himself and his campaign from David Duke and only did so reluctantly, there's this pattern here where it's almost like he has to be dragged kicking and screaming into repudiating stuff that should be instantaneously repudiated by any reasonable person.
You know, but you have to put additionally some other things that have been picked up by the alt-right and neo-Nazi community. Left out Jews and in a commemorance of Holocaust Remembrance Day. He talked about the 1965 Civil Rights Act and getting population to traditional levels. He's retweeted false crime statistics on African-American crime from racist sites. So there are a lot of gold nuggets that the extremist neo-Nazi and anti-Semitic extremists have latched onto, not the least of which was your invocation of his disciplining of the Orthodox Jewish reporter. Interestingly enough, the person who's been most presidential, and I wrote about this in a piece, front page piece from the Huffington Post, was Vice President Pence. Vice President Pence laid a wreath over at Dachau, then came back to the Missouri cemetery, rather, and actually gave a speech and cleaned up a bit. That's the kind of utterances that we've seen from elected officials in the past, usually the president, but the vice president certainly has been pitch perfect on his response. But it's unfortunate that it seems to be a counterweight to the president's hesitant and minimal response.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs at the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. So in your research then, Brian, What is the correlation then between sort of signaling, if you will, or not repudiating? Or let me give you an example. For example, this the Immigration and Naturalization Service, I mean, now called ICE, of late have been pulling over people, including Muhammad Ali's son, and questioning him about him being a Muslim. Various people have been stopped at the border coming in from Canada because they're Muslims. They've had their phones confiscated, their computers confiscated, etc. As far as I know, it's not official policy yet in terms of what the Trump administration's saying in their crackdown on so-called border protection and for people from these countries that they've named on that list. We know that immigration officials are given a broad latitude, that the officers basically have a pretty broad latitude. And it seems to me that even if the laws haven't been changed in terms of immigration, or even executive orders haven't been changed, by signaling a change in attitude, you've already got immigration officials who have the latitude taking, in effect, the law into their own hands and exercising their own attitudes and prejudices. So is that an example of what's happening at a national level? In other words, you don't necessarily have to change the laws or pass bills, but if you make certain signals of intent and a change in attitude, they are often translated as empowering people to go out and do stuff like exercise prejudice against Muslims or, in this case, against Jews.
Well, interestingly, with specific respect to the examples that you brought, meaning a law enforcement agency, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, over 25 years ago, were looking at responses to hate crime, for instance, and they found policies and executive leadership from the top down were critically important with respect to the efficient and positive enforcement of hate crime law. And I think you also hit a critical point in that there is wide discretion under current law. And the chief executive, really, both the president and the attorney general, set a tone in any Justice Department, for instance, as to what's going to be enforced over some other type or category of crimes. And he's signaling that he's looking at international terrorism and, for instance, marijuana. But what is troubling, and I testified before Congress on this topic, is there are also people who ruthlessly take advantage of undocumented persons. And many places, like Los Angeles with Special Order 40, will be highly cooperative with the victims of crimes. And I think if we're going to have changes in immigration through our democratic processes, it's incumbent that we protect communities and the police departments in those communities to do their job of basic law enforcement. That's why just last week, the Harris County Sheriff in Houston, which was the county that deported the largest number of people, has now said he's withdrawing the ability of his officers to be deputized by federal officials. And I think that's a smart move.
Well, in terms of the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, he's already reversed the Justice Department's overturning of a Texas restrictive voting law that meant that students couldn't vote without an ID or a student ID was not sufficient to vote. However, if you had a gun license, you could vote. And these were state laws designed to suppress the vote, clearly, in terms of Democratic voters and empower Republican voters. And that was blocked in terms of as a voting rights issue. And already the Attorney General has reversed that. So he's signaling at least in that direction. But where do you think the signals are coming that people are picking up, like these alt-right followers? And frankly, I don't think the alt-right is a sufficient description of these people. That's the term that people like Stephen Bannon have chosen to call themselves, alt-right. I think that they should be defined in the way that they are, as racist. And I don't know why we give them the benefit of the doubt of allowing this kind of term that seems to sort of sanitize the true nature of these people.
You know, I think that's an excellent point, and I always try to preface that it's a sugar-coated new new cereal box, and it's gluten-free, but it's the same repackaged sweetened hate. But, there are some differences, actually, that I think are worth noting. Doesn't make the alt-right less bothersome or less bigoted. But with regard to substance, the alt-right was really about not only going after Euro-nationalism as a main tenet, but also of taking down the Republican Party and other kind of traditional institutions that they saw were blocking their message. And that's something that other groups like the previous Klan or even other neo-Nazi groups were never quite able to do successfully. Part of the reason that they're able to do that is they're downplaying the use of swastikas for substitutes that might not be obvious to the casual observer. But I think you're absolutely right. With regard to Mr. Sessions, he also was the Senate's primary opponent of the Shepard Byrd Hate Crime Act. And that law requires attorney general approval or that of his handpicked designee for any violent hate crime case to move forward under the federal government. And we've written a couple of pieces about that as well.
So then, but just to the point about where's the signal coming from that's empowering racists, whether they're alt-right or traditional, KKK types, where's the signal coming from? Why? I mean, has your work indicated who's behind this rash of anti-Semitic activities? Because it's different from anti-Muslim. We know that that's happening, and that's, you can make the direct connection between the Trump administration's rhetoric and these incidents at airports, et cetera, which, to the credit of the American people, they've stood up and demonstrated against. But this, bringing back this sort of disgusting, kind of zombie-like hatred that has been around forever, going back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion, you just think that at a certain point they will die off like the KKK. It's pretty, almost completely irrelevant today. But something's happening.
That's a great question, because I think you hit it on the head. We have a traditional history of quiescent and then resurgent anti-Semitism. There's usually in the Western world, every 125 years or a bit more or so, some kind of pogrom or big attack. And the roots of that are traced back to the notion of deicide, that Jews are morally responsible for the death of the Savior, Jesus Christ. Then second, the notion that Jews are a separate race and a parasitic one. And then the third theory, all these have come up, have been conspiracy theories related to the fact that Jews were a merchant class that could lend money because of religious restrictions on Christians. So the notion of killing Christ, the notion of conspiracies, as well as other things have been recurrent. Today, when there's a nationalist populism, one of the great recurrent outsiders who are part of these conspiracies can relate to Jews. And we saw at the tail end of Mr. Trump's campaign some internet advertising that showed Hillary Clinton and under her Janet Yellen, George Soros, and Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs. So what we're seeing is part of this is overt support from hardcore neo-Nazi alt-right types, but white power slogans were yelled at a Trump rally in Alabama. We also saw Matt Heimbach, the head of a hate group, manhandle an African-American female protester at another place. So what we're seeing was hard racists were showing up to these things or retweeting things and claiming that Trump represented their view. I'm not saying that Mr. Trump himself is a bigot of that sort, but this kind of support that we've seen by extremists for one successful candidate is unprecedented, perhaps since 1968 when George Wallace won five states in the South.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Brian Levin.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. Previously, he served as associate director of the legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he recently testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how technology is disrupting democracy and could undermine it further.
Well, I'm going to tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists bound to lose.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Johan Bolin, who's a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing. He was formerly a staff scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory and an assistant professor at the Department of Computer Science of Old Dominion University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Johan Bolin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Johan, you're quoted in this extensive article at The Guardian and also The London Observer, a profile on Robert Mercer, the big data billionaire who they say is waging war on the mainstream media. And he has links to Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, and Nigel Farage. And this right-wing U.S. computer scientist is at the heart of a multi-million dollar propaganda network. That's pretty much how the article is framed. So in general, clearly, technology is disrupting democracy, and it may well end up undermining democracy. But at this point, is it a question of who uses the technology better that wins the race, or is this a question of the technology itself is the problem?
Well, I think the jury is out on that last one. I personally saw the rise of the first web servers, I'm old enough to actually know the first Belgian web server to be set up. I think the promise of a lot of the internet and the social media we've seen is that it would connect people, bring them closer together, aid for the unobstructed distribution of information that was relevant to our democracy. But I think lately what we've seen is that there's inherent features of these social media environments that might cause these echo chambers to emerge, where people, like-minded people, essentially cordon themselves off and only listen to the information that they themselves propagate through their own little echo chamber social network. And in addition, some of the research that we've conducted on mood propagation and contamination might actually suggest that these environments could be subject to deliberate manipulation.
Well, let's walk through some of what happened in the elections in terms of what the Guardian article brought out in terms of Robert Mercer's role. Now, I recall that there was an attack by Republicans, I'm not sure who they were, on Facebook. They were alleging that Facebook had a liberal bias because so many people, in fact, it's up between 2/3 and 3/4 of Americans get their news from Facebook. That gives Zuckerberg enormous power. They were arguing that he had a liberal bias. So he got rid of the human curation and then introduced algorithms. And then suddenly that's when fake news happened. So it's hard not to see a coincidence there that Bannon and company were ready with fake news. And there have been studies that showed that since Facebook got rid of the human curation of their news, fake news proliferated and real news receded.
Yeah, I'm not so sure whether there's an actual connection between the two, because that would be really difficult to demonstrate that something like that was actually the case. But I will say that this is a real conundrum. The distribution of fake news and hoaxes, etc., is very difficult to prevent on algorithmic grounds, right? Because the algorithms just don't have the sense that a journalist or a human expert has. And once the features of those algorithmic solutions are known, of course, that also opens the door for abuses. On the other hand, if you have human experts judging the quality of the news that's being distributed, they can be accused of bias, and there might actually exist a bias both on the left and the right. So it's a real conundrum. I think the real issue here is not whether the algorithms are good enough or whether there's particular bias among the experts. It's that these environments, these social media environments, allow people to connect to like-minded people. There's a very strong degree of what we call network homophily happening. Birds of a feather flock together. And that allows people to, essentially build an information ecology that to a large degree relies only on like-minded people. And these environments, in addition to that, they have recommendation services, they have algorithmic approaches to making sure that we receive things that we like. And so that strengthens even more so the isolation that people experience within these echo chambers. So my fear is not so much, deliberate bias on the part of experts or the failure of algorithmic solutions to fake news or hoaxes, but the fact that we're being cordoned off in these echo chambers that prevent us from actually receiving or absorbing different viewpoints from our own.
Well, but the charges were, for example, that Cambridge Analytica, which is a company that Mercer is, I think, one of the main owners of, and Stephen Bannon is on the board, that they, in effect, did a dress rehearsal using their data mining abilities of social media to target messages ahead of Brexit, and therefore being in part responsible for that surprise upset. And then they took these same tools and used them in the US election on behalf of Donald Trump. In other words, you're saying that the condition exists where people create their own information ecology through social media and live in this little bubble. But on the other hand, the real issue is, can you exploit those bubbles, target messages to them, and therefore, influence the outcome of an election?
Yeah, I think most research indicates that kind of manipulation would definitely be possible. And so if I understand what was done by Cambridge Analytica, is that they used data that would allow them to construct a very large scale psychological profiles of the individuals that were targeted by a particular news story or piece of information so that it fit their personality as well as possible. And so what we're talking about is almost custom tailored propaganda that has been specifically designed for groups of people that have been deemed to be most receptive to it. Again, that's, all propaganda attempts to do that to a certain degree. But what we have here is that, the social media environments have essentially allowed us all to create the data that people can feed into these algorithms that can then be turned around to characterize us, to psychologically profile us, and to generate propaganda that is perfectly suited to our own preferences and to our own psychology. So what we're seeing is sort of an evolutionary step in the design and the implementation of propaganda where the data that we ourselves have donated to these environments. If I go on Facebook, for example, and I post updates, et cetera, there's a whole history. There's at least an 8-year history of me right now on Facebook that these algorithms can analyze. They can build psychological profiles of my likes, my dislikes, et cetera. And, of course, that will allow a propagandist to tailor messages specifically to my preferences and specifically such that the intended psychological outcome or the effect on my voting preferences would be what they seek to accomplish. So, you're right that this is most likely possible, but it's possible precisely because of the data that we've all collectively freely donated to the social media environments.
So some of the work that you've also done, Johan, is on also relates to Robert Mercer, the billionaire main backer of Donald Trump. He brought in Stephen Bannon and Kellyanne Conway into the Bush campaign. They previously were supporting Ted Cruz, and then when he started to fail, they moved across, and he became Donald Trump's biggest donor. But the source of his wealth, or at least one of the main sources of his wealth, is his company called Renaissance Technologies, which is a hedge fund that makes money by using algorithms to model and trade on the financial markets. And apparently his profit margins are absolutely astronomical. Tell us about how algorithms also, in a way, work to the point where this man is able to essentially print money by just gaming computers. This is not traditional capitalism in the Rockefeller, Carnegie, Henry Ford. they don't produce anything except they just make money out of money, but all in the ether of the internet. Is there also an emotional component to that as well?
Yeah, I wouldn't be sure whether your characterization of Mercer's strategies, et cetera, is exactly fair, because, you know, essentially when people trade on the stock markets, they do so with the best possible information available. And so in our own research, we've been able to show that the social media environments, because of the large numbers of people that participate in these environments and again, don't freely donate information on weather conditions, road conditions, their economic conditions, their emotional state, their psychological states, etc., that they actually do carry signals that you can extract algorithmically signals from those environments that seem to have some predictive value with respect to stock market fluctuations. So if you have the computational power and you have the right algorithms and you tap into these social media feeds, yeah, there's 300 or 400 million people on Twitter right now, almost a billion people on Facebook, you have a wonderful slice of the human population, a sample of the human population right there available to you freely, telling us how things are for them, how their economic conditions are, what they're worried about, what their emotions are, whether they're fearful, whether they're happy, etc. These kind of signals, this kind of information can be analyzed by computers. And then essentially what you have is you're not really printing money, but you're just making better investment decisions. You're trading on the basis of more accurate information about what's happening in our economy and in our social lives.
So what is the secret then to Mercer's success? The 70% profit margin from Renaissance Technologies algorithms in terms of
I can't say what the secret is, because obviously
it's a secret.
These are well hidden.
Right,
it's a secret.
I get that
exactly. Yeah, I figure. But if I would venture a guess, it would be something similar to what we've been able to show in our research, namely that emotions shape future behavior. And investors, to some degree, are driven by emotions. And so if you can tap into those emotions in real time, you might have an edge with respect to market fluctuations that are driven by the eventual decisions that traders make. And so this is not a game of computers. It's essentially using computers to analyze more accurately and in real time what's happening in society and in our economy to make better investment decisions.
Well, but I think the issue that I wanted to get at and get some information from you, Johan, about is the difference between observing and using emotions and manipulating emotions. In other words, it's one thing, and I'm talking about this in the political sense, it's one thing to be able to mine all of this social media to come up with an idea of what people are feeling and being able to make judgments based upon what is already pre-existing emotional ecologies in these little communities online of like-minded people. That's one thing. But the other thing is to get that information and then to turn it to or manipulate it to your advantage. And is that what we're talking about here in terms of what I began the conversation with, which is about technology's disruption of democracy or perhaps undermining of democracy?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, our research is based on essentially performing an observation and then correlating the observation to future market fluctuations. But your point is that same information might actually be used to build models that would allow certain people to manipulate, collective emotions at a very large scale. And, you know, I think that might actually be possible. There's been some experiments done. There's actually been some published research that shows that it is actually possible to manipulate people's emotions by tuning what they receive and what they see and what they hear from their friends, etc. So, yeah, that does open a Pandora's box to the degree that that our political life, our social life, and our individual psychology might actually, to some degree, be affected by deliberate attempts to manipulate us and using these social environments as a tool to do so. So that is definitely something that worries me as well. I mean, I think that it could. Some of my colleagues here at Indiana University have actually done quite a bit of studies on the number of bots that are available. So these are essentially computer programs that pretend to be people and that post content in these on social media environments. And the purpose of those bots is specifically to either manipulate the information that is being distributed in these environments, or potentially to even manipulate people's emotions and feelings for potentially for economic gain, if not, for example, to win an election. So that is something we need to all be that we need to be very careful with. I think that will be. I think this will become an increasingly important problem for our democracy. And not just our democracy, but our socioeconomic well-being. So, yeah, and I'm ranting here a little bit, but I think you're right. In principle, with the right kind of models, with sort of armies of bots and followers, you might be able to actually steer public opinion and collective mood states in the direction that you would favor.
But that's one of the charges that the intelligence community has leveled against the Russians and against Putin himself, directing this campaign to help elect Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. It was based upon the idea that they've used troll farms. And what you're referring to in politics is called astroturfing. In this case, they're not really people. They're just bots. But isn't that already happening?
Yeah, well, again, I don't know what exactly the Russians have been up to because I'm not privy to their internal strategies. But again, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's definitely possible that sort of intelligence services or propaganda services would create these you know large armies of trolls and for astroturfing campaigns and use bots to particularly steer the outcomes of elections. I fear that might be possible.
Well, we know that there are troll farms. I mean, for example, because I've been investigating this Russian connections, my mail that comes from listeners now is overwhelmed with Russian spam and phishing, etc. So it seems to me that there's something happening out there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, again, if it is possible at all, and I think the research seems to indicate that it is, then it's just another tool in the arsenal of your average propagandist. I mean, this is, again, there's nothing new necessarily about propaganda, except that now it can be conducted at an enormous scale, and I think it's also become a little more insidious, because if national television is broadcasting propaganda, it's pretty obvious to people that's what they're doing. But in this case, you have essentially billions of people that participate in these social media environments. That's where they're getting the news from. They're getting it from online friends, from people that they've chosen to follow and that they've chosen to communicate with. And so in that sense, I think this type of propaganda, especially when psychologically profiled to suit our preferences and our psychological makeup, it has become a lot more insidious. And so, yeah, I am not aware of sort of the secret strategies of the Russians or the Democrats or the Republicans or anyone like that. But the science seems to suggest that the social media environments have created a fantastic tool for the manipulation of public opinion.
Well, Johan Bolland, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Johan Bolland, who's a professor at the Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing. He was formerly a staff scientist at the Los Alamos National Laboratory and an assistant professor at the Department of Computer Science at Old Dominion University. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's increase of 10% in the military budget at the expense of the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department. I'm watching you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Roxana Tiron, who covers defense, business, and national security and Congress for Bloomberg News. Previously, she covered defense for The Hill and was a reporter and assistant editor of National Defense Magazine in Arlington, Virginia, a fellow at the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism in Washington, D.C., and worked for CNN's Inside Politics and Worldview. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roxana Tiron.
Thank you for having me.
And Donald Trump is proposing a 10% boost in defense spending, adding $54 billion to the defense budget. And what's your sense then of going forward? Is this going to be challenged in any way? The Democrats don't have the votes, but what's the justification for this defense spending beyond his campaign promises? I mean, that's what it sounds like, that he's simply going to do whatever he said in the campaign, whether it makes sense or not.
Yeah, first of all, I think, yes, it is a way to fulfill his campaign promises. And I would just say that you should look at it as the opening salvo. He can propose a $54 billion dollar increase for the defense budget and cut elsewhere in the government's budgets and agencies, but Congress is the arm of government that needs to approve the budget, and so this is just the beginning. So even though the Democrats don't have the majority in the Senate, they do have some critical votes for any kind of appropriations bills, and they do have the Senate processes where they could stall or delay and even stop any kind of bill that significantly cuts social programs, for example, from becoming law. It'd be a much harder fight, but it is possible.
Well, when I mentioned that there might be some pushback, on the other hand, Republican Senator John McCain said that this increased budget up to $603 billion, which the White House has just outlined, he's saying it's saying it's insufficient. So McCain...
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So what's his argument?
Yeah, and actually Max Thornberry, so they're the top Republicans on the Armed Services Committees in the Senate and the House. They have proposed their own budget blueprint, and their own budget blueprint for 2018, for fiscal 2018, is $640 billion. And that does not include war funds, which obviously are not subject to budget caps. They only count against the deficit. So they are clearly very unhappy with this proposal. It's a lot less than what they would proposed. So they've been very critical today of this move. They are also expecting a war supplemental for this fiscal year, for fiscal 2017. But because the supplemental is solely focused on war needs and fighting Islamic State and other military operations around the world, it actually. Limits the kind of money that can be spent on the big defense programs that both John McCain and Max Thornberry want to see. They have made the case that the military is significantly depleted, that the readiness for a future war is just not there anymore, that the military not only needs more personnel, and as you know, people are the most expensive, but also new fighter jets and ships and helicopters. So all of that money needs to come in the traditional regular defense budget. So even though the Trump administration is expected to ask for more war funds in 2017, and most likely their budget request will also include war funds for 2018. They're a little bit hamstrung on how to spend that money. They just want to see it on the big defense programs and personnel. So some of it cannot be spent through the war funds. And so that explains why both McCain and Thornberry are so dissatisfied with the budget request.
But where are they getting their numbers from and the wish list? Is this some wish list that comes from the Pentagon itself, or does it come from outside groups like Frank Gaffney and others that are always beating the drum for more defense spending?
It's a combination. I would say they have done, their staff and them have done their own analyses on what is needed, and they keep going back to the sort of pre-budget caps. Type of funding, and so they have made their own projections as to what is needed, based on I guess in particular what the services have told them sort of in recent months and you know last year about the state of the force and the state of their equipment, the state of their training and flying hours, and I think in part the services contributed to sort of. The larger amount that they're projecting, through their testimony. They also have submitted, and this is all, it's not considered official channels, but because Congress has requested and the Armed Services Committees have requested these lists that are called unfunded requirements or top unfunded requirements list, the services did submit to Congress, more than $23 billion worth of, equipment and personnel that they would need just in 2017 alone that Congress hasn't funded. So I think it's a combination of testimony on the Hill, of their direct talks with the services, their talks with think tanks, their own staff doing the analysis. So I think it's a bigger picture than just being influenced from the outside.
Now, at this point, what the White House is telling us and the budget director is that this extra $54 billion that Donald Trump is asking for defense will be offset by cuts in the Environmental Protection Agency and the State Department. Well, the Environmental Protection Agency's total budget is only $8 billion a year, which is nothing compared to the Defense Department. And the State Department's annual budget is $50 billion. Now, of course, there's a little bit more to be taken out of that. So $22 billion in direct foreign aid. So let's start with the Environmental Protection Agency. That doesn't seem realistic. I mean, out of $8 billion, how much can they possibly save?
I mean, they haven't specifically said how much they would cut, but they specifically indicated that that the Environmental Protection Agency and State Department are sort of the biggest targets. But it's a little bit unrealistic to think that they can really shave off most of their budgets. It's just not possible. And also, other agencies will most likely be targeted to make room for this $54 billion.
Well, that's when it gets there's going to be pushback, right? If they go after Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, and other social programs, because the president himself has promised he wouldn't touch those. So,
correct. Yes.
So what is what's left? I mean, there's not much discretionary spending, any rate, is there? That's non-defense.
Well, there isn't, but I mean, there's always agencies and always ways to cut more money. And as I said, at the beginning of our talk, it will be up to Congress. I mean, this is just a proposed budget. Congress has its own ideas where the money should go and how much money should go to various agencies. They also have their own ideas of how funding can be offset. And so this is just the beginning salvo. We don't really know yet how this is going to play out. But what is certain is that this is going to be a fight, and this is going to be a fight that the Democrats are not ready to lose. And we actually had a story today. A colleague of mine, Stephen Dennis, interviewed Dick Durbin, the you know, the second top Democrat in the Senate, who said that, you know, a government shutdown might even be a possibility over you know, proposed cuts. So, you know, we are just at the beginning of a pretty long financial or budgetary saga on Capitol Hill.
Well, traditionally, of course, the State Department doesn't have a domestic constituency, certainly not like the Defense Department, where so much money is spent on contractors, et cetera, whereas the State Department, its $50 billion annual budget is not that large. So there's not, you know, there's not a lot of people in Washington that are going to come to the defense of the State Department. But when you're talking about $50 billion, even if they cut 30% of that, which is what one of the White House officials said, that's a pretty, you know, one-third of a pretty low budget. What's your sense of the political support that there might be for the State Department?
I think you are going to see some pushback on such cuts. For example, I mean, it would spell a lot about you know, the United States foreign policy as well, and the United States involvement in the world. And some might argue that the State Department already has a pretty small budget and is underfunded. And so I think you need to look at certain senators. I think you know, like Lindsey Graham, who's in charge of the, you know, of the Appropriations Committee with jurisdiction over the State Department. And I don't think this is something that he, you know, that he would easily agree to. And it's not just Democrats, it's Republicans as well. You know, he's talking about, you know, creating various funds or, you know, sort of grants to help counter Russia's influence in Eastern Europe. He has other, you know, plans in terms of, you know, countering Islamic State's influence in the Middle East. All of that costs money. All of that costs U.S. involvement. And so I don't think that these are sort of, you know, easily said and done. I think people are going to carefully study this proposal and then probably counter it with their own.
Well, but you're talking about soft power, aren't you? When you talk about the Middle East countering Islamic State, that's in many ways, the Defense Department's already there bombing, and they've got advisors on the ground, etc. So that's hard power, and that's, you know, obviously different and separate from what they call soft power, and that is how to.
Yes, that is correct, but you have to also understand that a lot of the lawmakers on Capitol Hill do believe in soft power. And I think that's where you're going to see the resistance. And that's, you know, and it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, Islamic State or Russia. I mean, there's obviously other areas that they want to tackle in the world. And I think, you know, cutting the State Department so significantly would just hobble any kind of effort.
Right, but that's what I was going to suggest. When you mentioned Russia, the Russians under Putin have developed what they call hybrid warfare, where you don't go to full battlefield and you do it very subtly. You use surrogates, you use a lot of propaganda, you use a lot of influence, already we've got this major scandal here with the extent to which Russia was involved in influencing our recent election, and now there's charges that they're involved in trying to influence the elections in the Netherlands, in France, and in Germany. So is that all under the umbrella of soft power? And how much is your interactions with the Congress indicate that they're aware of this? Because there's obviously a lot of people are saying we need an inquiry into what happened with Russia. And then on the other hand, there are people like Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is trying to say that there's nothing there and we shouldn't have an inquiry. So it seems like when you talk about needing more money for soft power to counter Russian influence in terms of hybrid warfare, you're going to run up against that argument over the extent to which Russia was involved in meddling in the U.S. election.
In part, but also there is there is widespread agreement that Russia is meddling in Eastern Europe. And I think what Senator Graham was talking about in trying to establish a grant and a special fund to counter Russia was in particular to not only, help with the U.S. influence in the area and help counter Russia's spread of hybrid warfare, particularly for NATO allies and others in Eastern Europe. So I think it's too early to tell on how this is going to really play out. As I said, this is just the opening salvo, and so they still have to present the details and sort of the minutiae of how they're going to go about cutting the budget. They're only supposed to submit a what we call on Capitol Hill a skinny budget on somewhere around March 13th or 14th. And then the sort of more detailed budget is just going to come much later, a couple months later, just because the OMB director has just been installed. So I think you're going to see a lot of debate on Capitol Hill and some surprising debate for perhaps the president's party, as you saw today with John McCain and Mike Thornberry being extremely critical that this is not enough money for defense. I think this might play out in surprising ways.
Well, just in closing, one of the areas that White House officials have said that the Trump request for increased money, $54 billion in the 2018 budget, is for shipbuilding, military aircraft, and establishing, quote, a more robust presence in key international waterways and choke points, such as the Straits mm-hmm. of Hormuz and the South China Sea. You can't sort of just write a check and suddenly the next day you've got a bunch of extra warships in the Straits of Hormuz, right?
No, absolutely not. You cannot. And in fact, shipbuilding could take quite a while, particularly if you want to build, if you look at the littoral combat ship, for example, which might not even, depending on where they are in international waters, might not even be the appropriate ship. But it's an extremely troubled program that the Pentagon is cutting off with 32 ships and then figuring out another way to build a new frigate, to fit the requirements. So we've been going back and forth for about a decade or so on this program. Building carriers takes a long, long time, and so does building destroyers and submarines. So I don't think it's something that you're going to be able to see in 2018. What you're able to see is maybe speed up production and order materials and sort of get things going to build more ships and as congressmen and women like to call it as a down payment, to start building up the Navy. But it's going to take years.
Well, Roxana Tarun, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Roxana Tarun, who covers defense, business, and national security and Congress for Bloomberg News. Previously, she covered defense for The Hill and was a reporter and assistant editor of National Defense Magazine in Arlington, Virginia. She's a fellow at the Washington Center for Politics and Journalism and worked for CNN's Inside Politics and World View. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.